Hello.
Hi, my name is Anne McElhenney.
And I'm Phelan McAleer.
And welcome to the Anne and Phelan Scoop.
Yes.
It is week 68 of the 2 week to flatten the curve lockdown. And that's 68 weeks, that's 1 year and 4 months since...
Since the government said we're just going to close everything for 2 weeks to flatten the curve. And actually it's 4 weeks. Well, actually, let me just make one thing clear.
Do make one thing clear.
I'll make many things clear, hopefully.
I hope so.
But if it wasn't for Gavin Newsom's recall election, California would be in another lockdown now. You know, this Delta, we'll talk about the Delta variant later. But, you know, so when the government tells you this is only for, something's only for 2 weeks.
Run for the
hills. Hide. Emigrate.
Yes. Go to Montana.
Yes.
Or Wyoming or somewhere where they're free, where people are really free. Yeah. There aren't, basically Florida. I think it's basically Florida.
Yes.
And it's, by the way, very important. Another marker that we're now doing, which I think will be a feature of our show.
Yes.
It's 4 weeks now since the mainstream media has decided not to report on the fact that the president of the United States' son, Hunter Biden, used the N-word repeatedly, and apparently it's not a big deal.
Yes, it's not a big deal. They can ruin a 16-year-old's life.
Yeah.
By the way, I just want to thank everyone. We made an appeal last week, and we're going to renew the appeal this week for you to help us to make the My Son Hunter movie. We are approaching having raised $1 million, but we're still some distance away from that. But we really need your help. If you're listening to the podcast, if you like the podcast, if you like what we do...
If you like us... At all.
At all. If you like the Irish, anything.
That's right. Yeah, any of those.
Any of our
cocktails.
If you, yes.
Yes.
The banter.
The banter. The lovingness.
The
lovingness. And talking of the lovingness, actually there's going to be some news. We're going to have slightly different way the podcast will be for the next little while because I'm going to Ireland for a secret mission.
A secret project.
On a secret project. So we will be doing, this will be, first of all, very sad, by the way, it'll be the first time that we've been apart for as long as we're going to be apart. But
in the life of our marriage.
In the life of our marriage, but we're very busy working, so maybe it'll be very focused on all of that. So, yes, so I'll be in Ireland, but I'll be bringing some kind of regional news from Ireland, and I'll also do a little bit of kind of Irish tourism. I'll show you a little bit of the parts of Ireland that I love, and I'm sure there'll be weather and recipes.
Now, don't you be casting the glad eye at any of those Irish men in their woolly jumpers. No?
Their
curly hair.
I already got a man with a woolly jumper.
Yes, and curly hair. I used to have curly hair.
He had curly hair.
Yes.
Actually, you know what? We should put up a photograph of Phelan with his original curly hair.
Yes.
With the gorgeous curls.
Yes.
Whatever happened to those curls?
I don't know.
That'd be
the COVID.
Do you know what it is? It's the Delta variant. It's straightened out the hair on them.
Yes.
It's either that, by the way, or climate change.
One of the two.
Okay,
I mean, luckily, all the guys with the curly hair and the woolly jumpers now in Ireland are liberal, so you'll not be looking at them.
Later in the programme, we're going to be talking to Katie Pavlik, our old friend.
Hold
Katie
on, we
Pavlik.
Haven't done our appeal. We didn't actually do our appeal, yes. So please go to mysonhunter.com. I got distracted with men and woolly jumpers.
I hope not.
Go to mysonhunter.com, give what you can. Look, people, this is a guy who, while smoking crack cocaine, as is his, he's perfectly free to do that, he was getting paid $86,000 a month. 83.
But he was getting money from everywhere else.
Chinese
as well.
Government, Chinese investment funds, the mayor of Moscow's wife. He was, according to his own emails, he was cutting the big guy, his father, Joe Biden, in for 10%. So, these are legitimate questions. Is the President of the United States, is he relying on funding from foreign entities through his son? And we're gonna make a fun movie about that. We have some very interesting cast news coming up soon, hopefully. And we need your help to make it. We're going to be filming it in Serbia because it's going to double as Ukraine. It's just going to be a romp. It's going to be Austin Powers meets King Lear meets House of Cards. So please help us make this movie. Hollywood will cover this up. The mainstream media will cover it up. Go to mysonhunter.com, give what you can, and send it to your friends.
Just to add to that, you know, like obviously, as Phelan says, it's going to be very entertaining, but this is an incredibly important story of what these Bidens were up to. You know, as we go out with this show this week, you know, I mean, at the very same time, you have anyone at all connected with the Trumps being persecuted and paraded in courtrooms and handcuffed for things that, you know, for things that never have been in court before, basically, right?
That's right.
At the same time as the President of the United States has these massive scandals that are not being covered by
the
media.
Even the New York Times, and I found this buried deep in an article, the New York Times was forced to admit last week that, and we'll put that up now, that it's practically unheard of for anyone to be prosecuted for not paying tax on perks. Yeah. That's a tax matter. Yeah. It's not a criminal matter. I know that not paying your tax is a criminal matter, but, you know, not paying tax on perks, it's just...
But another part of that story that just struck me, by the way, you know, and I know, you know what that word is? What is it? Proportionality, right?
Yeah.
So they're going after this associate of Donald Trump's, you know, his whatever it was, is an accountant of his. They're going after this man in his, that is in his, he's in his 70s now. And the number, the amount of money that's involved is I believe it's $1.4 million. However, the state of New York has spent millions of dollars pursuing this $1.5 million, you know. And I think there is an issue in law about proportionality. Is there not?
No, there's not.
There's not. Well, there should be.
I think it was a judge in the 60s in England said, you know, using a hammer, a sledgehammer to crush a butterfly.
Oh, right.
You know, and they were saying that they shouldn't do that. But that's more of a judicial philosophy rather than a law.
Just say that yesterday I was walking somewhere and I got hit in the face by a butterfly. Very first time it's ever happened to me. And I am interpreting that as really good luck, by the way.
I'm sure the Chinese have a saying about that.
You know, in Ireland, they have a thing about if a ladybird, if you ever see a ladybird on your hand or whatever, or any part of you, it's very, very good luck. But anyway, I wonder if anyone out there has heard of this thing of getting hit in the face by a butterfly. I'd say it's very good value, very, very good, very good news.
Not good news for the butterfly.
Phelan, we're going to tell you what we're doing in the show today. So yes. In the show today, we are going to be talking later on to our dear friend, Katie Pavlik,
yes.
Who is an award-winning journalist and obviously Fox News contributor. You guys all know her.
Yes.
We're also going to be bringing you the story, you know, I remember a few weeks ago we talked, and by the way, we've talked many, many times about the blackout in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And we made the point here that what happened in Texas, the blackout in Texas, is coming to a state near you.
Yes.
Well, guess where it's come to right now, and we're going to tell you about that later on. And tell us about the world's greatest thinker.
Malcolm Gladwell, you know him, the tipping point.
Oh, he's so interesting.
He is nothing but a poser, and we'll be telling you why.
Yeah, we're revealing that story here. And the Delta variant.
Delta variant, Delta variant.
Delta variant. Da-da-da-da. I've got the wrong music there. It's more like...
That was more Star Wars.
No, this should be more like scary music.
Dung, dung.
I think we're going to have scary music. Dun. That's exactly it. Delta variant.
Dun, dun.
Delta variant.
Maybe the editor could play some.
So a couple of weeks
shark
ago.
Shark music. Here.
So dun. So a couple of weeks ago, you know, I became aware of this massive conversation about Delta variant that was happening.
These are the teasers.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Right. We'll talk about the Delta variant later on.
I've been trying to tell my wife this since we've been starting this podcast. There are teasers and there are shows.
There's a cat. Oh. Hello. So this is Mr. Scaredy Cat.
Who stayed out all night, the dirty stop out.
Stayed out all night, the dirty stop out. And look at him. He's had a few things to eat and he's licking his lips there. Lift him up. There's Mr. Scaredy Cat. Hello.
Scaredy Cat.
Scaredy Cat.
Does whatever a cat does.
Okay, Phelan. We have Julie cat. And we have Magda here with us today. Both of whom
are allergic to cats.
So let's kind of keep a hold of Scaredy Cat, or at least maybe open the door and hope that he'll jump. You see, you know what he's going to probably do now? He's probably going to jump on Julie.
Because she's the most allergic of us all.
And that's what they do. That's what cats do. It's almost like they know that. And they're seeking her out. But look at him. And look at him licking the lips. Okay, enough about the cat. And the last thing that we're bringing you today will be a recipe for a new take that I have on a skinny margarita. We'll do that on the patio later on.
Okay, so that's the end of the teasers, Anne.
But first,
now we get
over
to the show proper.
And we're going to go over right now to our really dear friend for the first interview. Well, the first interview, the only interview in this show today, which is with Katie Pavlik.
Yes.
We'll go over that now. So now we're joined by our dear friend, Fox News contributor, author, award-winning author.
Best-selling author.
Katie Pavlik. How are you, Katie?
I'm great. How are you guys? It's so good to see you and hear from you. We need to see you in person soon. I miss you guys.
I know. And I was just saying, just because we never had you on our podcast before, so we're really delighted we could get you on today. Thank you so much for this.
No, thanks for asking me. I love it. Thank you.
And I was just, I'd like to start by thinking about my role in your success, Katie. Can you remember what year it was that you and I met at Heritage?
Oh, I would say it was probably 2010.
Yeah.
Right here. Yeah.
And do you remember what I said in my speech?
You said something very kind about me. I remember that.
Well, I went. So here's what I was
thinking about, because you were such an idol of mine in the things that you guys were doing. And I loved hearing you speak, not just at Heritage, but at CPAC and all these conservative events when we were in the height of the Tea Party movement.
Yes.
And you guys were calling yourselves recovering Europeans and doing your documentaries. And it was just amazing. So,
well, I just want to say something about you, because what happened was Katie was an intern in Heritage. And I made a speech, but before I spoke, you came up and talked to me and asked me a bunch of questions about journalism, about, you know, where did I get my start, and like very clever, interesting questions that I hadn't heard from many students. And it was a kind of, as you say, it was 2010, and a lot of people were very upset about what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the speech I said, for everyone who's out there, who's upset, who's despairing, who's down in the mouth, do not give up. Don't worry. We're all going to be fine, because people like Katie Pavlik exist. And I know your mother wrote to me afterwards. And of course, I know your mother, and we've stayed in your mom and dad's house and all of that.
Yeah.
So we know Katie quite a while.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Our partner.
Yeah, well, I'm grateful for those kind words, but you were such an inspiration that day, and you've inspired so many people to get into media and journalism, ask tough questions and pursue topics that, you know, now are being censored on big tech platforms and that we can't talk about, you know, climate change being one of them. And I, for years, have recommended Not Evil, Just Wrong. It's an incredible piece of journalism and work. And I always tell people about your work, because it's contrary to the narrative and full of facts that people need to hear about. So,
yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, it's funny. I would want to tell people, like, there's never been a better time to go into journalism to tell the truth, because so much of journalism has become corrupted now. Mm-hmm. I mean, journalism is dead, which is a great opportunity for anybody
who wants to do journalism.
I mean, there's so little opposition now. I mean, you know, there are so few people digging for stories,
right?
Because the left now see it as their job is to be anti-Trump, is to promote the Biden administration, is to stop Trump getting reelected, to stop Republicans getting reelected. They also seem to think their job is like Twitter archaeology, where they go back and find somebody's embarrassing tweets from 10 years ago, and that's journalism, and get them canceled, or find a joke they told. And it's just not, it's not what they, you know, it's in journalism, real proper journalism. There's a massive market opportunity to any young person out there. I mean, every time people go into journalism, they're always told by senior journalists, there's never been a worse time to go into journalism. I'm telling you, there's never been a better time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's tons of opportunity. There are more platforms than ever now to be able to do your work and show your work. And, you know, I just think it's amazing to see how journalism has gone in such a short period of time from pursuing the truth and working on behalf of the public. I mean, that's mm-hmm. really what the job is of the White House press corps and of journalism broadly. And I think especially over the last year, you know, combined with, of course, the three previous years of the Trump administration, but especially with the pandemic, so much of that has been exposed, and mm-hmm. the so-called journalists who are supposed to be working in the interests of the public and for the public good and to help Americans make good decisions and to provide them with proper and true information rather than just to fulfill a narrative, that got thrown completely out the window in favor of political narratives, in favor of fear mongering. And it's really unfortunate, because a lot of people's lives were affected by it, and not questioning, you know, people like Anthony Fauci, for example, early on, and questioning, you know, more of why he was changing his positions on so many different things could have saved a lot of people's livelihoods, their lives, mm-hmm. Their health, and not talking about both sides of the story. That's like the one thing that you learn in journalism school, right? Is like to tell both sides of the story.
Yeah.
And there has been none of that over the past year with the pandemic at all. It's been one narrative, one focus, only one expert opinion matters. And that's so antithetical to what it's supposed to be about, and also antithetical to science, by the way. So it's just been so eye-opening to see, and frustrating, but as you said, it's a great time for people to go in and to tell that other side. And you know, I find that there are a lot of young people that I get to work with as interns and at the National Journalism Center who are interested in doing that. So I'm not so down in the dumps about that. I think there's
It's you know, I mean, again, I don't want to go on with this, but it's, you know, we're all journalists here, and I mean, when I see, you know, 150 job layoffs, advice news, and there's this kind of outpouring of grief on Twitter, or, you know, I'm just going,
good.
I'm going, well, like, what did you think was going to happen? Right. You know, I mean, you kind of dug your own grave, right?
By not pursuing actual stories.
By not pursuing stories. By not, you know, because there's a lot of people out there telling the narrative that everyone's telling, and it's boring after a while.
I was going to say, it's just so boring. I mean, there's no diversity of thought or, you know, storytelling, and it's not just journalism. I mean, it's Hollywood. I mean, now every single film has to check, you know, the diversity boxes, and therefore the narrative of every play and every film is basically the same. And People are wondering why nobody wants to go to the movies or to participate in the arts. And it's like, because you've sanitized all of it. You're not being creative with the process, because you're more interested in fulfilling a narrative than you are of just following the fact where they
go. And as we say, like, they spent 50 years attacking Republicans and conservatives in the movies. Mm-hmm. Then they close the movie houses and they're trying to get people back in. But the only people who have the courage to go out in public now are conservatives, right? Liberals are still sitting in their houses wearing double masks.
Right.
And that's the base they appeal to go to the movies. And they're not going, and they're going, shit, damn, we've got these movie houses and our base won't go. And I'm going, well, if you hadn't have alienated half the country, we'd be flooding into the, we go to the movies here in Venice, California, and we're the only people in the theater.
Yeah, we're on our own.
Because all the liberals are still wearing masks.
Yeah.
And sitting at home.
I guess they don't need the conservative moviegoer anymore since they're so beholden to China. So
yes, well, that's true.
They found their other audience at this point.
Yes.
So one of the things we wanted to ask you, you're living in Washington, basically, in greater Washington, or I hate the word greater.
Let's call it the swamp.
That's appropriate.
And a friend of ours who's been living there for many years said the last couple of years have become totally unbearable because of wokeism. And he's actually leaving and he's going to move to Florida. How is it for you? Well, what do you, think?
What was it like in the Trump years, actually, in the swamp? And what's it like now?
Well, so I've been here since the Obama years, and politics aside, I have always, as a kid, I came to Washington, D.C. for a leadership camp when I was in high school that my parents sent me to. They had this rule where for every two or three athletic camps I went to, I had to go to an academic camp. So they sent me to this leadership camp in Washington, D.C., and it was awesome. It was amazing. And then I came back in college to figure out whether I wanted to move to D.C. or New York to pursue a career. And what I've loved about DC always is that it's for all of the politics and the swampiness and the disgust of the politicians here, it really is the capital of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And the National Mall and the National Monuments, and driving by Arlington Cemetery every day, that's never lost on me. And that's something that I appreciate as an American. And I think that it's a place where everybody should be able to come and feel comfortable walking to the White House, walking to the Capitol, going to the Lincoln Memorial, and to feel like it's their city too. I mean, Washington, D.C. is not a state for a reason. It's the capital of the country. It's a place where all Americans should feel like they're able to come and be proud of their country, regardless of who's in the White House. And so, you know, that was where I started. I'm still there, but the last 4 years, I would say really the last 2 years have just been really, DC has turned into a very crime-ridden city again. There were, you know, at nighttime, there would be, like last summer especially, there, you know, be burning the city, quite literally burning the city with these Black Lives Matter rallies and riots. You know, it used to be you could walk to the White House and just go right in front of the White House. Under Obama, there was a smaller fence, and the fence kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger through Trump until now. And now you still can't even walk to the front of the White House, which I think is a real shame, because Americans should be able to walk to the front of the White House and to see where the president lives, and go to the Capitol and be able to see where their representatives supposedly represent them, right?
Yeah.
And so it's been, especially over the last year, in terms of like local leadership, and I guess leading up to the presidential election, things got worse. Mm-hmm. But generally under Trump, I mean, it was kind of fun because there were a lot of conservatives in town working for the administration, you know, really kind of sticking it to the man in the swamp, because as you know, probably, you know, some of the bluest counties and ironically, the richest counties in the country are just outside of DC. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of, you know, fun to see everybody kind of congregating in the same places, because those were the only places they could go, finding their safe spaces, so to speak, but you were with other conservatives. But in terms of the general vibe of where DC is right now, it just feels very closed off to the American public. And I think that's a real shame. And obviously, you know, the pandemic literally closed things off, but just generally in terms of walking around some of the sites and these amazing places that Americans should share together and be able to just walk to, it's been, I don't know, kind of difficult to watch those things be shut off from Americans who live in a democracy and are supposed to be able to be in the middle of, you know, the representation and part of the system.
And has wokeism infected the city much? Or
Yeah. I mean, it's, I'm sure you've seen the videos. I mean, we don't go to dinner outside in downtown DC. We don't really go out there because over the summer, last summer, you know, and throughout the year, quite frankly, and in the springtime, you'd be eating dinner and then these mobs of people with bullhorns would come by and demand that you raise your fist. And so, you know, it's not just wokeism in terms of like, maybe the menu has some,
yes,
and about equality or, you know, a living wage or whatever. I mean, that's in a lot of these businesses, and like, they're a private business, they can do what they want. But these roving gangs of, you know, terrorists, people rioting and intimidation, it makes it unbearable to want to go and to be customers at those businesses, which is a shame. So, you know, that the wokeism is definitely more militant than just the sign in the yard that says hate has no home here, right? it's an actual action that is, you know, forcing people to be in a very difficult position. And it's funny to me because DC is not a conservative place. I mean, they would be going to these bars that are notoriously left wing, who have all of the flags and all of the signs about equality and anti-racism. And yet that's like not enough.
You
have to, you know, grovel and literally kneel with your fist up to these people when they walk by.
Because it's all about power.
That's a big shift. I hadn't seen that before.
Yeah, it's a big shift. Yeah, it's all about power. That's what, you know, it's not, they're not looking to reform the world or save people. They're looking about saying, look at me, I'm the captain now, you know?
Right.
And you're, totally. So that sounds terrible, but you know,
you're from Arizona, Katie, and a lot of interesting things have been happening in Arizona in the last period, and not the least of which is this recent Supreme Court decision. What do you make of Arizona right now? What's going on?
So I think generally the political landscape in Arizona is it's changing. You know, I know people who have stickers on their cars now that say "Don't California my Arizona," and there's so many people who flee California, as you guys know.
Yes.
But they don't change their voting habits, and so I think Arizona turning more purple and certainly trending, I would say, blue. And it's not just Arizona; it's Western states like Montana, even Wyoming. Utah, all of these places are being inundated with people who are fleeing leftist policies, but then they don't change the way that they vote. And this is not something that we just saw in 2020 with Trump allegedly losing Arizona. It was a culmination of things. So, you know, you had Kristen Sinema elected. Before that, you had losing that second Senate seat. The woman who's the Secretary of State now, who's running for governor, has a good chance of winning. And I don't think it's, I think it's because the demographics have changed a lot. But I do think that the Republican Party, in terms of the legislators there, are very, very conservative. And if you look at kind of what they've done with school choice and the Second Amendment and auditing the election and, you know, passing laws that make it harder to cheat in elections, the local level has been very effective. And I think that we've seen that a lot with Republican legislatures all around the country. You know, it's very easy to get focused on DC and what DC is doing and the overreach of the federal government. And it's very important. However, Republicans are running the table when it comes to the state level. And they're pushing through a lot of really good pieces of legislation on a number of issues. So.
And do you think it's interstate immigration? I suppose there's also growing Hispanic immigration as well in Arizona. And you think it's an inevitable that people that California, that Arizona will keep moving towards the blue, or is there something that can be done?
Well, I always joke about how if you move to a different state, either blue to red or red to blue, you shouldn't be able to vote for 4 years. It's kind of like a barrier to entry, right? Like you got to live somewhere for a while before you ruin it.
Yeah.
There's no, you don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat. It's just, that's the criteria.
Well, sorry to interrupt this. I remember Breckenridge a few years ago, and I was in the ski lift with a ski instructor, and we were talking about environmentalists. And he says, you know, my definition of an environmentalist, and he goes, someone who built their holiday home here last year.
Yeah.
You know,
so they got in before.
Yeah, they got in, and they've got this beautiful view, and then somebody wants to build 30 houses in front of them, and they're going, no development here, and going, you built a house. Right. You know? Yeah. So it's the same thing. You shouldn't be allowed to vote on anything until you live there for 4 years.
Well, one of the biggest threats probably to Arizona and to many parts of the country is this unchecked mass assault on the border, which I know is an issue that's really important to you. And you've written extensively about that, including in a best-selling book. What's the situation now? I mean, what is happening on the...
Kamala went down to the border, Anne. Come on. Like, I mean, it's
all sorted now.
Kamala.
Did Kamala sort it out?
With her layover in El Paso, where she did, you know, barely left the airport. And that's another rule. If you don't leave the airport, it doesn't count that you actually went, in my opinion. You know, it's like, you can't say you've been somewhere until you leave the airport.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously we see everything that's happening in Texas with people, thousands of people a day coming over. The situation in Texas is very different than the situation in Arizona. I was actually out there in April, and I did a ride along with the Pinal County Sheriff's Department, and the kind of, the issues that they deal with there are different in the sense that they're dealing more of the criminal cartel element that's more violent. Obviously, there's a cartel element in Texas, but it's just a different situation with the human trafficking. Obviously, every single person who comes over is paying something like $10,000 to get trafficked across the border. So what I learned in Arizona was, you know, they are making more money now on people than they are on drugs.
Wow.
And there's two points there, right? Like the first is that humans are a commodity to them. I thought we lived in a country where we don't treat human beings as commodities, right? Mm-hmm. But they are being treated as commodities. And in Texas, people are paying to basically turn themselves in, right? They think that they're going to be able to get processed and, you know, released into the country, and they'll be able to stay for the rest of their lives. In Arizona, it's a little bit different because they have mostly males being smuggled, and what they go to great efforts to conceal themselves in the desert. They wear, you know, speaking of environmentalism, they wear many layers of clothing, at the top layer being camouflage. And they go to these drop spots where they then strip off all of the clothing and leave it in the desert. And they're completely trashing all of these sites. And the reason they do that is so that when they get to their pickup site, they have civilian clothes on. So if they were to get pulled over by a local police officer or something who, you know, maybe who doesn't have their jurisdiction to ask about legal status, or can't at least detain anybody for a long period of time if they don't have a legal status, they look like they're just civilians rather than people who just hiked across the desert.
Yeah.
So it's just it's talking to the human trafficking division there. They said, you know, look, under Trump, things completely stopped. They joked about maybe not having a job because things were so under control.
Yeah, I just want to explain. Right? Under Trump, there was a thing called, I think, the Mexico policy, where you could come to America and claim asylum. And that's, I mean, it's kind of misleading, all these pictures of people jumping over walls, and a lot of people are just walking up to the border and saying, I claim political asylum. And under the old rules, that you were then taken and processed and released, and then you could melt into the black economy and either turn up for your hearing or not, which would take years and years, and maybe have a child, and then you couldn't be deported. And that was the system. Trump said, sure, you can still claim asylum, but we're going to send you back to Mexico to a nice residential center there, where your claim will be processed, but you have to stay in Mexico. And that ended the incentive of people coming across the border. So that's why they were out of work. Is that correct? Am I reading that correctly?
That is correct. And also, you know, if you're truly claiming asylum, you can also claim asylum in your home country. And so that's kind of the farce of the whole thing. I mean, if you're really, truly at risk and you're not engaged in asylum fraud, which something like 90% of these cases, or if not more, are asylum fraud. You would go to the first place that's available, which yes. would be in Guatemala, which would be in El Salvador, which would be in Honduras, to claim that political asylum. So yes, that was certainly a deterrent. This idea that you can come and make the journey, but you're not going to wait in the United States. You're going to have to wait in Mexico to do that. And you know, the people who are turning themselves in, that's a problem economically, politically. It's a complete destruction of the rule of law and how we should have some semblance of order at the border. But the issue in Arizona, where these guys are sneaking in, you know, they have criminal records, they are violent, they have bad intentions, they're engaged in very serious crimes in the United States. And what people don't quite understand either is that, you know, parts of Arizona are completely run by cartels. I mean, they basically run the territory, and whether that's drugs or humans now, but it, you know, they have sovereignty over parts of, yeah. you know, my family there, you know, they're hunters. And if you look at the map of where all the tags are available, there's hundreds of them available right on the border because it's too dangerous to go hunting. Yeah. There.
Well, you said, you said there's more money in trafficking humans now than drugs. And I suppose Democrats do have a long history of trafficking in humans.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. That's why they're not speaking out against it. Exactly. Yes. They seem to be perfectly fine with it.
Yes.
So you mentioned hunting, and I know that you're an avid hunter yourself. Under the Biden administration, what's happening with, well, I kind of want to segue onto gun control and the gun issue. What's happening? What should people know about what the intentions of the Biden administration are in relation to the guns issue?
So they're trying to push through this ATF nominee, David Chipman, who is an avid, rabid anti-Second Amendment advocate. And, you know, they kind of disguise him as a gun owner and someone who understands the issue. And, you know, he was an ATF agent and therefore he, you know, knows and has experience in how these things should be handled. But he believes in gun confiscation. He believes in banning the AR-15, which is the most popular modern sporting rifle in the United States. They want to change this rule on what are called pistol braces. 40 million Americans own pistol braces. They're attached to a pistol. And so essentially that's one of the largest confiscation schemes we've ever seen in the United States.
We have a lot of experience with guns in Northern Ireland, but most of them were illegal, yes. probably for good reasons. What's a pistol brace and what does it do?
So a pistol brace is essentially, it looks like somewhat like a stock, but they put it onto an AR pistol. And so it was originally developed by a guy who made it for his disabled veteran friend who could strap it on his forearm and use it that way as an AR pistol. So it's good for self-defense. It's more compact. But the pistol brace is basically just an accessory. I mean, it doesn't do anything other than it's a piece of metal and a piece of plastic. And 40 million people own them. So now legally, ATF wants to make this rule where they counter, you know, they go back in time and say, well, now this is illegal, which then that gives people a choice. Do I register my firearm and my pistol brace with the federal government, 40 million people, and pay a $200 tax on each one that I own?
Wow.
Or do I become a felon by not doing that? And then there's this issue of enforcement. So they're trying to change this rule retroactively to make 40 million people who are legal owners of this type of accessory and firearm felons overnight if they don't comply with confiscation or turning it in.
They don't need to worry though, honestly, Katie, because apparently, you know, you can do all kinds of things with firearms and, you know, and skirt with getting a felony. But if your name is Hunter Biden, you're grand, right. You'll be fine.
Yeah. That's going to be everybody's defense from the defense attorney. Well, my name is now Hunter. I'm identifying as Hunter Biden, and therefore I can't be prosecuted for lying about what I may or may not have. But just real quickly, you know, on that issue, you know, during Chipman's ATF confirmation hearing, he said, well, I don't make the rules. The Senate makes the laws that I enforce, right? So even though I have these personal views on the Second Amendment, I'm not going to act on those. We know that's not true, especially at ATF. We've seen that with the FBI. There are plenty of people who broke all kinds of laws and rules and process to engage and implement their political viewpoints and goals. At ATF, when people who have political agendas like gun control are in charge, very bad things happen, like Operation Fast and Furious, where they use a brilliant idea to give criminals guns in order to get law-abiding citizens in trouble. And so it's a very dangerous situation that they're playing with. So we'll see if he comes through and gets off.
We should point out Katie wrote a best-selling book, The Fast and Furious.
Operation Fast and Furious.
About the Obama plan to give, as you say, to give criminals guns and track them.
Long ago now, it's so crazy. But
yeah, and it was basically to show that all the Mexican cartels were being had got their guns from America, which is nonsense, complete nonsense, by the way. No, but it was to prove
to them. ATF was forcing the dealers to sell to people they knew were giving guns to cartels.
Yeah.
We're coming near the end of the interview, and we've got two or three questions that we need to ask. But to go completely from the sublime and the serious to the really, really ridiculous, you've probably noticed this week the cover of Vogue cover of Vogue that's coming out, that's about to come out. I think they've just published it online. It has Jill Biden as the model on the front cover. And I think the line that they have with the photograph says, "A first lady for all of us." Mm. I don't know if you've read what they wrote about her. They thought that she's relentlessly popular, that she's just and that she's a princess. And it couldn't possibly be more sycophantic.
You could teach this article in journalism school how not to write, how not to be a good journalist.
It's literally a joke. What did you see that? And what were your thoughts on it?
Well, I did see the cover. I did not take the time to actually read what was written, but this is reminding me of Hunter Biden's recent Vanity Fair piece where there are just overwhelmed with how talented he is because he's blowing paint through a glass straw in his pool house for his art career. Mm-hmm. And how he's, you know, under federal investigation, but he really is just such an artist now and mm-hmm. proclaimed and so just sophisticated with the way that he does things. But the double, you know, this is the thing, it's a double standard. Obviously Melania was a fashion model. She was absolutely beautiful. They never bothered to put her on the cover. I think I saw today that Vogue hasn't put a Republican first lady on the cover in 100 since its founding, basically. And I just think it's really dishonest because they pretend, you know, a first lady for all of us. Okay, well, maybe not, you know, but we could just at least be honest about that.
Yeah.
And they just lie about it. Like, you know, they're open-minded, they're tolerant, they're open to supporting all kinds of different women. When it is so blatantly obvious that they are not, despite the qualifications of Melania Trump, to be on the cover of Vogue, right? It's not just because she's the first lady, but because of her background and who she is. And so that's one side of it. The other side of it is, do we really need to care anymore about what the legacy media and magazines like Vogue think? I mean, is it really a problem that Melania wasn't on the cover of Vogue? Are we really trying to get their approval, right? I would say at this point, no. Now, if someone wants to give me $100 million to start a women's fashion magazine, I am available. I would love to do that. Yeah. You do it, you know, in a way that is very similar, but you promote other women who may have a different perspective, who also like to engage in fashion and all of these things that Vogue writes about. You know, I think that's what I think as a woman is frustrating, is they think that they represent all women and yet they completely eliminate an entire sector of women from the conversation on a constant basis, whether it's Melania Trump or women on college campuses. So
I just have to read this because you didn't read it and you don't have to. And
we'll
do it for you. Here's how they described her: a joy multiplier. I mean, this is not a joke. This is what they said: joy multiplier, a goddess, driven, tireless, effortlessly popular, but also someone who reminds us of ourselves, which she doesn't remind me of myself at all, by the way.
That's the thing. It's like, actually, no. And I think if you read the reviews from students, from some of the students who have been in her class, they would disagree.
Yes.
Yeah. And I like the other thing, by the way, the other thing just to point out, they do talk about a scandal in this Vogue article, this 6,000 word puff piece about Dr. Jill Biden. They talk about the scandal of the fishnet stockings. They actually talk about the scandal of the fishnet stockings. Apparently she wore, you remember that, she wore fishnet stockings or whatever, and they were a bit of a style disaster. But
apparently.
Yeah, I mean, she's unbelievable. But listen, we've come to the last two questions. We ask all our guests two final questions. And I know you recently got married and we're all delighted.
Not recently.
You know, recently enough, by the way. You and I will be married 20 years, by the way, Katie. We'll be married 20 years this September.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I'm going on four Monday. So our anniversary is Monday.
Four years. Oh, wow. Okay. So the first question is about cooking. And I'm wondering who's doing the cooking in your house? And do you have a recipe that you're famous for in your house now?
My recipe is making the coffee in the morning.
She's another Magda. She's another Magda.
I there's a few things I can make that are edible, like chicken and zucchini. But everything else, my husband is a wonderful cook. Just like my dad was the cook in the family growing up.
Women.
It turned into beef jerky. It's like there are things in life I'm really good at. Cooking's just not, I admit, it's just not.
And by the way, can we just say, that reminds me of your dad, because your dad made for us. Do you remember this story? Because you weren't there and we were staying with your mom and dad. And remember what her dad made? Did he not make buffalo lasagna? Did he not make lasagna?
Elk lasagna. He probably shot, which he harvested in the field and brought to your plate. So,
oh my God, it was fabulous.
Farm to table.
But I actually it's so funny because I was just talking to Magda before we started taping, and I said to Magda, I wonder is Katie and her husband a bit of a you and Paul? Because Magda, you know, we make the joke here, Magda hasn't been to a grocery store since she met her husband.
Yeah.
And it's literally true, by the way.
Yeah. I'm a grocery store moron. I'm so inept at going to the grocery store. It's like, I'm so grateful you can order your groceries now. It's so much easier for me. I'm just an idiot when it comes to the grocery store. I really am.
Yeah, but you're actually better than Magda, just to say, Katie, because Magda can't even make coffee. Her husband, she can make the coffee.
No.
She can make it, but her husband makes it.
Her kid makes it.
Eric makes it. Actually, Eric, it's his job, and he's in charge of
it. Magda makes me coffee.
He needs a job. That's good. I like that. It's yours.
Yeah. It's a good one. Our second and last question is, we ask people about a piece of art, a movie, a poem, a play, a painting, something that is important that you would share with our audience.
I don't have some well-known piece of art that I love. I've been to the Sistine Chapel in Rome. I've been to Jerusalem. I've seen a lot of beautiful art in Paris. But for me, my mom she commissioned this dining set for us for our anniversary last year and for Thanksgiving by a local artist in Sedona. And you guys have been to Sedona.
Yes.
So that I think is really special because it's one of a kind. It's someone from where I'm from made it. And it's really, really beautiful. And it's ceramic art that maybe isn't going to be in a museum, but it's special to me. And I also have a lot of, I wore these today.
They're beautiful.
Native American turquoise jewelry, which is takes a lot of, it's silver and turquoise, and it takes a lot of creativity and effort and hard work. And this particular turquoise is from the mine. It's called Sleeping Beauty turquoise. It's from the mine in Globe, Arizona, where my dad grew up. So I have a lot of really beautiful turquoise jewelry that was made by hand by somebody, again, where I'm from. And so in an age where everything is made in China and everything's duplicated, I really think that those things are special and I like to be able to use them. So for me, like art that I can use is something that I really cherish every day.
Well, I know our listeners and our viewers are going to want to see the dinner set. So would you please send us a photograph of the dinner set?
I will.
We'll put it up. Because actually, we did go to Sedona. And in fairness, despite the politics of Sedona, Sedona is one of those places. I remember driving there and, you know, you're driving and driving. And the next thing, everything goes red, right? And it's such a shock.
It's a beautiful place.
Stunning. And it's funny, we were just having a conversation actually with Julie, who's one of the team here, yesterday, and we were talking about travel and people going abroad and all that, and we were saying, and she was sort of saying, oh well, I haven't been abroad much, whatever, and we were like, you know, why would any American go anywhere until they've seen America? Because it's not like it's one thing. You drive and it's like, what is this that I've just seen?
It's completely different.
It's a completely new place. So you drive around. And we've seen a fair bit of the country, but there's tons of it we still haven't seen. Yeah, we haven't seen the redwoods, but we have been to...
We haven't seen the sequoias. We haven't seen South Dakota.
We haven't been to Hawaii.
Actually, interesting. Sedona may have interesting politics. We just got a very good donation for the Mice on Hunter movie from someone in Sedona. Interesting.
Oh, okay,
so
well, thank you.
All these people.
I don't think it's as politically bent as you may think.
Yeah, okay. I think maybe there's a lot of old...
Some places, actually.
A lot of old hippies who went there who run their own businesses now.
Well, and you know what? This is a thing. Old hippies are the real hippies. They're the real freedom fighters. They're not these like fake people now who think that being a hippie is all about government controlling your life. I mean, the real hippies are the classical liberals, right?
Yes.
And a lot of them just really, you know, they're out west. They want to be free.
They want to be left alone.
Overreach and people telling them what they have to do every day.
Talking of Arizona, by the way, Katie, any plans to, let's just say, adopt a political career maybe and go back and save Arizona?
I think that's a question you get asked quite a lot, though, Katie. What's the latest thinking on that?
The last thing that I want to do in life, besides cook, is run for political office.
Could you be a bit more emphatic? She seems a bit wishy-washy about that now.
Not that I can't be convinced, but I really like being in media and telling stories and debating that way. And I'm happy to write about those who may be interested in the position.
I can certainly understand that. But it's a beautiful, Arizona is a beautiful state. We spent quite a bit, you know, we've been out to Scottsdale recently. And
drove from Scottsdale to La Jolla, a beautiful drive.
Oh, nice.
We decided we would, because the last, we've been to Scottsdale a couple of times. The previous time we went, we had flown into Phoenix and then got a car, and it was a major drama and the car was really expensive. So we thought, no, we'll actually drive from LA to Scottsdale. And then we had an appointment in La Jolla and we came back through La Jolla. And my big takeout from that trip was people, you know, here's a piece of advice. Get on the road in America. Yeah, get on the road, because even if the drive is long, you'll sit in the car thinking, my God, this is a great country. Mm-hmm. What a great country this is. And I would really highly recommend, get in the car. Don't fly anywhere. Just get out there and look.
And you're absolutely right.
What's the cat so wants to be.
That's a perfect message for an Independence Day weekend. Oh, hello.
That's scaredy cat.
That's scaredy cat.
He just
wants to. Okay. We're gonna end this now. Katie, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Thank you guys. Have a wonderful
Independence Day. Best of luck out in California, and hope to see you guys soon.
See you soon. Okay.
All right. Bye, Katie.
Oh, that was great. We love Katie.
Katie is great. Now, Katie is. We love
Katie. Of course, she'd be nothing without me.
Yes.
Important to say that.
I mean. Of course, I'm the same. What was I before I met you? What was I?
Well, you know, you had very curly hair, though, by the way, you met me. When we met, that it mightn't be the climate change that took the curl out of your hair. It could have been me, but I'm not going to say that, of course. So the next story that I want to come to, which is becoming my obsession. Mm-hmm. What happened in Texas and the fact that what happened in the blackout.
What happened in Texas does not stay in Texas.
And by the way, what happened in Texas, I said, you know, months ago, that it's coming to a state near you. If it can happen in Texas, by the way, there is literally nowhere else. There is literally everywhere else that it can happen. If it can happen there, it can happen anywhere. You know.
So tell us what happened in Texas, Anne.
So what happened in Texas was they were minutes away from a complete blackout of the whole of Texas during a cold spell that they had this past winter. Minutes away. And
thousands die in these blackouts.
Like tens of thousands of people would have died if that had happened. What they did was then they did have a blackout in certain parts of Texas. People were without power for days and days on end. And people did die, including a teenage boy. It is extraordinary that happened in Texas. It is more extraordinary.
Texas has more oil, I think, and gas in Saudi Arabia.
What's more amazing to me, by the way, is that this wasn't the biggest story ever and that we're still not talking about it, except for here on this podcast. But what I said at the time was, it's coming to a state near you.
But why is it? Why is it?
I bet it's going to come.
Why was it not?
And I bet it's going to come to California.
Yes, you did say that.
And it's come to California.
Yeah. There's the headline. California pleads for more power as summer blackout threat grows, hydro supplies fade. I mean, I love this headline, fade. You know, where's that from, that headline, by the way?
That's from the Sac. This is from the Sacramento. What do you call it?
Hydro supplies have not faded. Right. There may be, you know, what they call a drought, which is called weather in California at the moment. There may be that. But it's not a matter of hydro supplies fading. It's a matter of hydro power stations being closed down. It's a matter of an anti-dam movement that has taken over California, where they are dismantling dams, not building them.
It's very funny. When I used to, when we made Frack Nation and I used to go out and make speeches about power and about energy all over the country, I mean, one of the things I used to always say, it really is an amazing, you know, factoid, that the environmentalists love renewable energy, and the only renewable energy they don't love is the ones that work, right? Mm-hmm. So the ones that really work, the best renewable energy that there is hydro. And Phelan, what's the second renewable energy that works very reliably?
Nuclear?
Nope. Oh, but that second. Actually is a good point, by the way.
Geothermal? No.
No. Is wood.
Oh, yeah.
It's wood. And of course, I used to always make that joke when I was talking to people in colleges, was to tell people, you know, that the thing that environmentalists, they might have PhDs in ecology, but I'll tell you one thing that they don't seem to realise. They don't realise that trees grow. You know, and because trees grow, it's actually renewable.
So you can cut them down and replant them.
And they replant them. That it's not a tragedy when you cut down a tree, because another one, you can plant another one, you know, that kind of way. But so the two big, very renewable sources of energy that there are, that are clean, as they call it, you know, wood and hydro, they don't like. They really don't like hydro because, of course, it interferes with nature. So getting back to this story, getting back to this California story, here's what the Sacramento Bee wrote this week. Acknowledging the increasing threat of rolling blackouts this summer, managers of California's electricity grid issued a rare call for additional power supplies. In California, by the way, I'm just mentioning.
A rare call.
The California Independent System Operator, which runs the state's grid, issued the appeal to generators, traders, and others. The appeal, known as a capacity procurement mechanism, came 2 weeks after the state had a fairly close call in California, but was able to survive a 110-degree heat wave without resorting to blackouts. By the way, 110-degree heat wave in California, it's called weather.
It's called a summer.
Yeah, it's called a summer.
Palm Springs is called Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, it's called every year. Yes. I think that's the word.
Someone said to me, I met them in an airport once when I first came to America, and she says, I live in Palm Springs. I said, what's that like? She goes, well, the weather is interesting. I said, what do you mean? She goes, we say there's two seasons in Palm Springs, heaven and hell.
Yeah. Yeah, but and hell happens every year, and does it last 5 months, is it?
Yeah, a long time.
So here's what the public utilities here said. Summer has barely begun, and we've already had repeated extreme heat events, creating dangerous conditions and shattering records across the country.
By the way, California, why are you caring about extreme records across the country? Mm-hmm. Right? It's only, you know, because, by the way, the heat wave was up north. It wasn't here. We had no extreme temperatures.
No.
You know, that's a lie. That's you trying to cover something up there, because it's the heat in Oregon has nothing to do with how much electricity you need in California.
So basically, but I want to continue with this story from the Sacramento Bee, because it brings up a number of quite interesting questions. Here's what they said. Barely 2 months ago, grid managers were reasonably confident. By the way, these grid managers should be sacked. You know, that's just throwing that one out there.
You should not be a grid manager in California if you're only reasonably confident.
Correct.
That you will supply electricity.
Correct.
To the state.
Yes, and the reason for that...
You need another job.
Yeah, and the reason
I'm reasonably confident you need another job.
And that it shouldn't be reasonably confident, but super, super confident, is because California is full of energy.
Yeah.
It's full of oil. There is tons of oil here. There's tons of natural gas here. There is amazing opportunities for hydroelectric. And so they're
geothermal.
Recently,
you can go walking on Venice Beach. Correct. I come back with oil on my shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
From Venice Beach.
Or your bare feet.
Yeah.
So the reason that they now have gone from being where they should be, which is super confident, to this thing called reasonably confident, is because of renewables. Because the grid in Texas, and obviously the grid, whatever percentage it was in Texas, which was whatever, 23% or whatever it was, which was based on renewables, was relying on new renewables. Here in California, it's like, it's a lot more than that. And they want to make it 100% renewables. So the more it becomes further and further into the renewables, the less it becomes, they become confident. Their confidence will go away, Phelan,
mm-hmm.
right? Because those old fossil fuels, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
But, you know, but I love this, right? So they're, you know, they were 2 months ago, they were reasonably confident, you know, and that sort of changed. But since then, two things have happened. Listen to this nonsense from the Sacramento Bee. The mid-June heat wave.
Which one?
It's called weather, Phelim. Yeah, right? It's the weather. It's the summer.
There was no mid-June heat wave, by the way.
Well, there was, by the way. Forget now. You see, you live by the seaside, Phelim, right? Now, other people don't. Right. Now, Magda now is nodding her head there. Now, Magda doesn't live.
She's kind of shrugging her shoulders as well.
No, she's not.
There's a definite shrug. It was a shrug. No, she's not.
She's with me. It's every year. It's, oh, no, it's every year. Yes. But it was hot. But it is every year. So
I think it's a bit much to call it a heat wave now.
All right. Okay. Let me finish this.
By the way, as we found out a few years ago, there's no definition of a drought.
So there's probably not a definition of a heat wave either.
Yeah.
Okay. Two things happened according to the Sacramento Bee. There was a mid-June heat wave. Shocker. And a significant worsening of the drought. We talked about the drought last week.
There is
no definition of drought.
Yeah.
Which is cutting heavily. Listen to this. I love this. Which is cutting heavily into hydropower supplies. It's cutting into hydropower supplies. And I read that and I thought, I feel like I heard something about hydroelectric in California recently, right? So I went on, I just had a little quick look, really, really quick look, and found another story from the same Sacramento Bee from last year, from literally 1 year ago. And here's what the Sacramento, I mean, these people are the worst journalists in the world.
They won't even report on what their own paper has reported on.
So here's what they said last year. They wrote a story in the Sacramento Bee, here's the first line of it. Desperate to complete a historic but complicated dam removal on California-Oregon border, Gavin Newsom has appealed to one of the world's wealthiest men, whatever, Warren Buffett.
To keep the project on track.
And that project, by the way, the $450 million project, according to the Sacramento Bee, and here's what they wrote 1 year ago, would constitute the largest dam removal in American history. Phelim, are those two stories slightly related?
So they're complaining about lack of hydropower.
Correct.
Whilst in July 2020, by the way, when there was a few other things going on in the world.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
In July 2020, Governor Gavin Newsom
was desperate.
Desperate. To remove dams.
That was
his big. And the dams are owned by PacifiCorp.
Correct.
An Oregon-based electricity utility.
Correct.
So these were supplying. Some dams don't supply electricity.
Yeah, but this is hydroelectric.
This is a hydroelectric. Some dams are for agriculture. This is actually for, and then the Sacramento Bee a year later is saying, we can't understand why we're so short of hydroelectric power.
Well, it's the heat wave film that they never saw coming, even though it comes every year.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, these are really bad people. Like, this is just
dishonest.
I mean, these are just really, really bad people. I mean, I hate this. And by the way, this is scary, guys, because the lack of electricity, people, you know, having no electricity, losing power is a very, very serious business. It's not just about your fridge going out. It's not about the AC going out. It's not about that stuff. It's about hospitals going dark. You know, it's about people being plunged into darkness. It is extremely scary, and this is ludicrous, and it's coming everywhere because this is what's happening. All of the electricity grids are becoming more and more and more vulnerable because of this mad rush into renewables, and the renewables that work, like hydroelectric, they're against.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the maddest of the maddest.
Well, I mean, they're complaining. I mean, it's terrible. All these people dying up north in an actual genuine heat wave, and they're dying because they've no air conditioning.
Correct.
And because they're not used. We have air conditioning here, but you know what? Air conditioning needs to work. Electricity.
Correct.
And if you have a heat wave and you cut the electricity, people will die. This is not, you know, but Gavin Newsom is desperate to remove a dam.
Desperate to remove the dam.
As opposed to desperate to put air conditioning in poor people's houses.
So shame on you, Sacramento Bee, for not even reading your own newspaper and stating the obvious. Okay, Phelim, tell us about, I love this story. I just love this story about Malcolm Gladwell. You'll all remember Malcolm Gladwell. Phelim, remind everyone who Malcolm Gladwell is.
I mean, he's just God, really. He's the world's greatest thinker. According to himself and according to lots of million people. You know, here's from his own website. Malcolm Gladwell is the author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, The Tipping Point, Blink, Outliers, What the Dog Saw, and David and Goliath. And basically, his speciality, you know, I'll go on actually. He's also the co-founder of Pushkin Industries, an audio content company that produces podcasts, Revisionist History, which reconsiders things both overlooked and misunderstood. Gladwell has been included in the Time 100 Most Influential People list and touted as foreign policy's top global thinkers. And, you know, you look at the books, The Tipping Point, Outliers, David and Goliath. So he, what he does is he looks at things that everyone thinks they know.
Yeah,
right.
He rethink. Yeah.
And he says, that is not what you think it is.
Yeah.
The truth is actually much more interesting and much more complex and very often is the complete opposite of what you think.
And by the way, can I just say, before we start to tear him to shreds, which we will do in a moment.
He has curly hair, by the way.
Yeah, he does. He's not an attractive man. I think it's fair to say that. If that's not too awful of me.
His brain is attractive.
We talked to a friend of ours recently about him, and the truth about Malcolm Gladwell, Phelan, before we say what we're getting to, is that he has said some really interesting things, mm-hmm. and he has discovered some really interesting things. You know, and there's a second cat walking into the podcast room now, so I'm sorry for Magda and for Julie, because there could be some sneezing now, will have to happen.
Yes.
Oh, there he is up in the... Now, look at you. Did he come? Can you see him there? Look at that. Would you go away now? You see, look at that, looking for trouble. And a friend of ours was saying that in one of his books, for example, he had said this thing about, you know, a child staying back a year.
Yes.
Where, you know the way, and by the way, this happened in our family, so I know a little bit about this, where your birthday falls at a funny time in the year and your parents get asked, what's the best thing to do here? Do you skip, do you stay back a year,
yeah,
or do you skip ahead, right?
Yes.
And the basic rule that Malcolm Gladwell discovered through doing a lot of research on this was that having the child stay back a year, even though it seems like like not the right thing to do, is the right thing to do.
For the child.
For the child.
Yeah.
And that actually you'd be better off not skipping ahead,
yes.
and just getting that bit of more of maturity.
Because your child is the oldest in the class,
yes.
takes wise. A leader's position, is more mature. So it was enormously useful. So he does original research on important issues.
And he did another one. Can I just mention one other one, uh-huh. that he mentioned that I thought was really good and I read myself, which was where one of his books, I don't know which one it is, it's where... what seems like a disadvantage in life turns into an advantage. And it's one about, I think he made the point about dyslexia. And I told a friend of mine who has a child who has dyslexia. And they said that people with dyslexia, because they find reading very difficult, if I'm correct about that, they listen extremely attentively and become trained highly, highly functioning, like super, super, like it's almost like listening becomes a superpower for them. And that... it actually becomes an advantage in life.
Yes, yeah.
And so there were many, many examples of people with dyslexia who had actually done better than the average in life because of the fact that they actually had dyslexia, because they then developed a superpower.
Yeah.
So he makes these great points. But Phelan, we, with our friend the other day, had this conversation. And what's the point?
Well, I mean, there is a big issue at the moment,
yes,
isn't there? That's data-based... That's got huge social implications, got economic implications, that there's a lot of consensus on, but there's also a lot of contention about that consensus. And we're talking about the Chinese coronavirus.
Correct, the Wuhan virus.
The Wuhan flu. Yes. And,
one would think that somebody like Malcolm Gladwell, with his really interesting brain, right, would, I mean, almost like as a business opportunity, would say to himself, I'm going to have a little look at this thing. I might just have a little look at this
data. I should do a series on this.
I should think about this data because my brain is better than the average and I look at things a little unusually. So maybe I'll just look at this.
Yeah.
But you know what he's decided to do?
Yes, his fantastic new series of revisionist history. This is the advert. Listen up. Malcolm Gladwell's fantastic new season of his podcast, Revisionist History, dives into self-driving cars, college ranking systems, and the bizarre moral universe of The Little Mermaid. Like,
hello.
Hello.
Hello, hello, Malcolm. Malcolm.
Darling.
Earth,
honey.
Earth to Malcolm. Malcolm... There's a worldwide disaster going on. There's a catastrophe going on of some kind. Not necessarily because of a virus, but because of the way the virus has been treated. You didn't think maybe that you'd put your brilliant brain to work on that. Now, wonder what film could be the reason he's not dealing with the COVID. What do you think the reason for that is? When he's got this fresh and interesting
because
brain.
It's going to make a lot of his friends look very dumb.
Yeah.
You know, and also... You know,
are you saying, Phelan, my God, shockingly, are you saying that he's a scaredy cat? That Malcolm Gladwell is a scaredy cat? That he hasn't got the courage to use his rational brain?
And his massive research ability and his massive research staff.
And his massive fan base.
Yes.
And inform them about the truth about COVID.
You know, and by the way, maybe the truth about COVID is not what we think. Maybe the elites are right. Maybe Fauci's right. Wouldn't that be great?
And then Malcolm Gladwell says that.
And Malcolm Gladwell could be smashing the myths, the conspiracy theories about COVID. But he's decided to step out of it. And even when you look at what the thing he's doing, self-driving cars, college ranking systems, right? Okay, I get
whatever.
I get that. But why didn't you do, Malcolm, affirmative action for colleges?
Yeah, why don't you do that?
I mean, that's a great one because, you know, leftists say affirmative action is needed to address historic wrongs. Right wingers say it's just wrong that you're judged by the color of your skin. Others say, actually, it hurts minorities because what you're doing is bringing people to college and into elite colleges who are not able for it and forcing them to drop out. And then they become a college dropout rather than someone who went to a less prestigious college.
And did brilliantly.
Yeah. So, but maybe there's a third. Maybe his kind of unconventional brain will find that none of those are correct, one of those are correct, or there's a third way. It's actually, but you know, he doesn't want to go there.
No.
And so he doesn't really want to challenge consensus. He wants to challenge consensus about things nobody really cares about. The moral universe of Little Mermaid, yawn. You know, actually, very interesting. Remember last week we had this really interesting conversation with John Nolte. And we talked about the moral universe of Quentin Tarantino's movies.
Yes.
And he talked about the moral universe of The Bad Lieutenant. I mean, that's interesting. But, you know, Malcolm Gladwell is supposed to be, you know, three levels above us and John Nolte.
Correct.
And actually, you know what? He's not. He's just a pop consensus, pop, and he wants to be popular, you know?
That is exactly what's wrong with him.
Yeah.
Is that he is, you know, yeah, he's actually an incredible victim of the, it's like an illness. All he wants is to be popular.
Yeah.
So he is unwilling to address an issue that actually could really do with his fresh take. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because he's famous for the fresh take and he's famous for the rationality. Yeah. Throw that rationality at COVID there, Malcolm. And the fact that you're not is very telling. It's very telling.
Can I just say something?
You can say something.
We'll move on from Malcolm now.
I'm ready to move on.
But can I just say something? Julie, could you take a picture of us now? Because people can't see the incredible
situation that we've got.
We're now being
here.
Guarded by two cats and they're just out of shot.
Yeah, so people should see that.
Look at them.
I know. So I wonder, we've got a musical introduction to this next section. Phelan, if you would do the introduction, please. The musical introduction.
I think I missed that rehearsal.
Do, 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 do. Can you do that now?
Do, do.
That's do, it. Do. Delta variant.
Oh, Delta variant. I was thinking, what?
Delta variant.
Yes.
Phelan, can you now do the musical introduction for the next section, please?
Dong, dong. Dong, dong.
Delta variant.
Dong, dong.
Delta variant.
Dong, dong.
Delta variant. Okay, that's enough of that. Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. So, yeah, or we could use a psycho music, perhaps. So, Delta variant. So, a few months ago,
it started
being the Indian variant, and then it turned into the Delta variant. Basically, that's all they're talking about now in Ireland and the UK and all over Europe. They're just talking about... And by the way, up until quite recently, no one was talking about it here. I remember saying it to somebody the other day. I don't know if I didn't say it to you, Julie.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, what? The Delta variant? People hadn't heard
Delta
of it here,
Dawn.
Right? People hadn't heard about it here. They're all talking about it in Ireland. Now everyone's talking about the Delta variant here.
We were ahead of our time.
We're way ahead of it, but look at us, you see.
Delta Dawn, Delta Dawn, what's that variant you have on?
Oh my God, well done you, Phelan. Look at you being a little composer all there. So listen, here's what you need to know. I don't know. What do you need to know, Phelan, about the Delta variant?
So it's all a scam. Look, the Delta variant, it's apparently is more contagious. It is not more dangerous. If it wasn't for the recall here in California, we would have a lockdown because they really are itching to lock us all down again. And the Delta variant was giving them the perfect inroad to do that.
Yes.
It's not more dangerous. And by the way, places like the UK where 68% are vaccinated and they're postponing the reopening because of the Delta variant. I mean, it's just madness.
Well,
there is
never
a collective.
Ends.
This is why you need Malcolm Gladwell.
That's right. That's you right. Know, If he was brave,
but he's not.
No, he's going to talk about children staying back in school. Yeah, yawn.
And he's going to talk about Little Mermaid, and he's going to talk about...
The last thing he's going to do is anything controversial, because he has no... He is pathetic. He's pathetic. He's a pathetic
he's
man.
He's a pathetic poser.
Yeah, he's a pathetic poser.
Rebel without a cause.
But but on the idea of pathetic...
Rebel without a pair of
When you're
testicles.
Talking about pathetic, there's nothing more pathetic than the National Teachers Union of the United States, who have just made an announcement, basically. The NEA, the nation's largest teachers union, will call for mandatory, safe and effective COVID-19 vaccinations and testing for all students and staff before returning to face-to-face instruction in the fall, subject to medical exceptions. You know, shut. These are bad people.
These are
just bad people. They don't care that they're hurting children forever. That they're hurting children forever, and they don't care.
And they're trying to force them into a vaccination that they actually don't need, because the children are not suffering from. I mean, more children die in the ocean. More children die on roads. I mean, it's not an issue for children. When you hear
a story being reported, and there's a big piece of information left out. Always be very, you know, you've become super suspicious of that. So when you hear them talking about the Delta variant, they talk about that it's very, as you say, right, super contagious, more contagious, whatever. Who cares, by the way, if it doesn't hurt you, right? So the Delta variant, super, super contagious, yeah? But people aren't dying of it, right? They're not mentioning how many people are dying of it. And there's a reason why they're not mentioning that, because the numbers aren't impressive, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing that they're, you know, one of the things I want to do one of these days, Phelan, is literally do a whole show on the word context. Because context is something that has been completely missing in journalism about the COVID.
Well, we saw that.
And the reason that they're not doing context
is because the context
crashes
the narrative. It's like context of that Sacramento Bee story about the dams.
Yeah.
The context is that there's been an anti-dam, an anti-hydropower movement for the last 20 or 30 years.
And it's left the grid vulnerable.
Yeah, but you won't say that in your story. It's just like, this is the reality. We're suddenly vulnerable. Oh my God, what are we going to do?
So, well, we've come to the end of the show.
Yes, well, that was enough to make me want to drink alcohol again. No.
What does that mean?
Nice cocktail.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, thank you very much. Well, it's kind of almost healthy as well, you know.
And that's what I mean, healthy.
And you know what? I think it's very important. I love that. So I have a friend, Anne-Marie. I'll say her name, actually. It's fine. And she was a smoke. She doesn't smoke now, but she used to smoke. And when she was smoking, she would eat an apple while she was smoking. And it kind of did this thing in her brain where she thought, well, I'm eating an apple. It's really healthy, right?
It's like ordering a Diet Coke with
smoke,
your meal.
Smoke, eat a bit of the apple, right? And that's a little bit kind of what I'm doing with this skinny margarita, which is like getting you lots of vitamin C, right? You're getting lots of citrus, right? But you're getting a bit of Cointreau and you're getting a bit of tequila. Do you know that kind of way?
It's a balanced diet,
it's
really.
It's a balanced diet. You know what? Do it every day. And by the way, can I just say, it's kind of like coming out of the pandemic cocktail and moving into the skids. And actually, kind of good, by the way, can I just say, we've moved from the pandemic cocktail, which, by the way, was a skinny cocktail, to just a strict kind of skinny cocktail now. Because, well, let's be honest, we all need to be thinking skinny now a little bit, right? Because all those elasticated waists, you know what I mean, have to be considered. You know, we need to get into proper clothing again. I think we're ready for that now. Didn't we have a funny conversation about that the other day? What was it I said? Oh yeah, Phelan and I were in a coffee shop and we saw a girl wearing short shorts, and she looked, we thought, like she was going to the office. Bizarrely, she was it looked like she was getting coffees to go back to the office. And we were sort of saying, nowadays, is it a thing where you can't say to people, what are you wearing there now?
I think for the last 20 years you couldn't say
I think 20 years ago you could say to somebody, what are you wearing there now, right? So we were wondering, literally, can you go wearing a pair of short pants? And by the way, could you let us know that if you know the answer? Because I don't think, I would say it's illegal to say to someone,
you're dressed inappropriately.
I think that blouse is a wee bit tight there. So we've come to the recipe of the day.
The cocktail hour.
And the recipe of the day, by the way, isn't really a recipe, but it's a cocktail. Because, you know, by the way, at the beginning of this, do you remember we used to say on the podcast that we do, you know, we do recipes and we do alcohol? And we haven't done that much alcohol, actually. We may have to rectify that. But anyway, listen, I think this is a great cocktail. And I think the magic ingredient here, anyway, I haven't come up with a name for this. So
maybe people could suggest a name.
Perhaps people could suggest a name. But this is a margarita drink, basically. A margarita, but we need to find an adjective that goes in front of that. I was going to say a healthy margarita. You know, basically, as I told the story about, Let me go ahead and tell you this recipe. So what we're going to do here is, and the secret to this recipe really is a lot of citrus. And some of us love citrus.
So you talk about, what's the recipe for that dish, right? But I don't think people talk about what's the recipe for the cocktail.
They talk about actually it's the same as with food. There's ingredients and then there's how do you do it. How do you do it? Okay, let me just do this right now.
Next time I'm in a cocktail bar, I'm going to talk to a cocktail waiter. What do you call them?
A mixologist.
And say, what do you describe the accumulation of the details of how you make that. What is that described as? Marissa, oh, Magda has looked it up on the Googling. She's done some Googling.
It's a recipe. It's just like a recipe for food.
I think that's wrong. I think it should be a separate word for alcohol. So I'm going to try and think about it and invent a word and become famous for inventing that word.
Fair enough, Phil. You know? So
it's an ambition.
Here's the cocktail for today, and here's the recipe for the cocktail for today. And we're going to call this maybe a healthy margarita, which is kind of naughty, but whatever. So here's what we're going to do. So we're out on the patio here. And so what we did was, and I just loved, you see my juicer? That was my present to myself this year. I love it so much. And I know it seems like a huge thing for squeezing limes, but I just love it. So what you're going to do is you're going to squeeze a half of a ruby red grapefruit, half of that, loads and loads of juice in that. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to do a half of a lemon, and we're going to do two limes. And you see those, and see the jam jars. I love these jam jars. I have got a thing about jam jars. I just don't, and you probably, what do Americans call them? Julie, what do Americans call them? Do they call them jam jars? Or they call them mason jars here, you know? We call them jam jars, and you call jam jello, just to be clear about this. So
no, they call it jelly.
One of those things. So basically, we have the juices in those three, and what we're going to just do is we're going to then put, and I think it's kind of easy to do this because I look at a lot of recipes for cocktails and they talk about ounces and it's like, what? Here's the easiest thing with this recipe. I love it. A quarter cup of tequila, a quarter cup of orange liqueur. Ding. And in this case, that's Cointreau. And by the way, you know, you put a quarter cup of that and a quarter cup of that in, and then you're going to put in all those juices. So a half of a ruby red grapefruit, a half of a lime, and two limes and a half of a lemon. And then throw in your ice, and then shaky, 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 and then just pour that into a glass. And you can decorate that with a lime. I was having some difficulties decorating it, so I just threw the lime in there, which I think looks rather delightful. And by the way, can I just say, I just made this recipe up, and I think... It's a real winner. Really nice. And actually, can I just say that Julie tasted it as well, and she had the same point that I had about it, that sometimes these kind of tequila drinks are a bit strong, where you feel like, oh God, right? Not with this, because there's so much of the juice in there. Now, one thing that I had meant to do with this cocktail, and I didn't do, and I'm glad I didn't, was I was going to top it off with soda water. I don't think you need to do that, because I think we both felt, right, Julie? We kind of felt that actually it was nicely diluted with all that citrus juice. It's gorgeous. And you see how it look? I like the look of it in the glass too. That kind of cloudiness to it. Yeah. Really, really gorgeous. So and I think the trick, can I just say, I think the trick is the half a lemon. And by the way, can I honestly admit and confess that I got the idea from Ina Garten, who I do really like her recipes. But I think the half a lemon is the trick.
Which idea? You got the half a lemon idea?
The half a lemon idea.
But you're saying that is an Anne McElhinney special.
This recipe?
Yeah.
It could be, you know. But
McElhinney's margarita.
McElhinney's margarita. You heard it first here.
But probably the people who have the Tabasco sauce might have a problem with you.
No, the Tabasco sauce people have a different spelling than our McElhinney.
Yeah, McDonald's, if you have a shop called, there's a woman, one of my first stories in journalism was a woman, her name was McSmith or whatever, and she was opened a sandwich shop and she called the shop Mac Sandwich. And McDonald's sent her a cease and desist letter. So the McElhinney's of Tabasco sauce, even though it's a different spelling, may send you a cease and desist if you try and say McElhinney's margarita.
Can I just say that I would love the Louisiana McElhinney's to notice me, because my father was very sad all his life that we didn't have a closer relationship with the Tabasco McElhinney's,
yes,
who made a gazillion dollars by this incredible recipe for Tabasco sauce. And you know, just think about it. Every kitchen in the world has a bottle of Tabasco sauce. Every good bar in the world has a bottle of Tabasco sauce. That's a lot of bottles of Tabasco sauce. I told you that story one time before. I don't know if I told that story here on the podcast. I'm going to quickly tell that story before we go on to the next story. But basically, I went to Louisiana. Did I already say this story before, Mac? Because I went one time, I was doing a speech in Louisiana and I booked into a hotel, you know, in kind of some random place. I can't even remember where I was. And I'm booking in and I give in my ID or whatever. And they say, McElhinney, that's a familiar name around here. And I thought they were joking with me, because you never hear McElhinney, right, as a name. And of course,
I said,
what do you mean? They went, oh, we're just down the road from the McElhinney estate, which is this, by the way, I have never been there and I would love to go. There's like a McElhinney estate based on the Tabasco sauce where the family still own the business. And apparently there's a restaurant, you can have your wedding there. I'd say it's gorgeous.
Yeah. One of these days. So it's one of the few fifth generation businesses that still exist. I mean, most businesses don't survive to the third generation.
Because this one of the generations of children become an alcoholic, is it?
I think they just lose their drive, you know. I mean, when your business is very successful, it might go, you know, the drive might trickle down to the second generation. But the third generation, they all become lawyers, I suppose, or they want to spend the money.
No, they want to sit on a deck chair somewhere in the sunshine, drinking cocktails with umbrellas out of them. Yes. That's what they want to do for the rest of their lives. So people do that. By the
third generation.
More people do that than you'd think. Mm. It's not a good way to spend a lifetime.
Oh, not a good way. Okay.
But I think a part of your lifetime could be spent like that. Can I just say? Just a little shout out for the whole idea of retirement.
Put a lobby in there. Put a lobbying.
Just throwing that out there.
And I don't know who you're talking to.
That maybe the Americans, just a little criticism, America, love this country. Absolutely. One little small criticism is I've realized that quite a number of Americans don't understand what vacation means. And I think it's really weird because I can tell you one thing. No one in Europe doesn't understand the word holiday and vacation. So most Americans, here's a news flash for you Americans, you mightn't realize. Most people in Europe have 6 weeks holiday a year, right? Like we can think about our friends.
And as a friend of mine said in the newspaper, 6 weeks holidays a year and then 2 weeks sick and that's 2 months off.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's a marvelous idea.
Again, I want to make an appeal. MySonHunter.com. Please go and give what you can.
We'd really appreciate it.
We're going to have a lot of fun making this. We want you to be part
of
the journey.
If you're one of those people who've been saying, I must give to Anne and Phelan, do it now. Do it today. And obviously you'll get a tax exemption because we're a 501c3. And we do so appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.